And thanks for tuning in to another edition of Global Revolutions. With all hiccups and all, we had a great show. Thanks to Ken Fitzsimmons from The Kissers and Andrew Thomas for his interview with Zakir Hussain, Rob McClure for the weather. This is Martin Alvarado. Thanks to the WRT staff, as always. Catch you next time. You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM.
With Sue Montgomery. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is joining leaders of Caribbean nations in Jamaica for emergency talks in the crisis in Haiti. The talks will discuss a proposal developed by the Alliance of Caribbean Nations, CARICOM, and Haitian stakeholders to speed up a political transition there. It comes after the World Food Programme warned that people in the Haitian capital are facing famine conditions as the security situation deteriorates. Jean-Martin Bauer is a WFP representative in Haiti.
We're facing famine-like conditions. These are the worst conditions in the international scale used to evaluate food insecurity. It's a 5-point scale, phase one being normal, two, stress, three, crisis, four, emergency, and five, famine. So we were at 0.5 of this 5-point scale for the first time in Haiti's history and for the first time here in Latin America.
The UN Secretary General has called for a ceasefire in Gaza to mark Ramadan, the Muslim month of fasting. Antonio Guterres also called for the release of hostages held by Hamas and the speedy delivery of aid to the Palestinian territory, where the UN has warned that a quarter of the population is on the brink of famine. Here's Lucy Williamson.
Overnight, Israel said its forces had killed more than 15 enemy fighters in Gaza, but others are counting the rising toll on civilians. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, called for honouring the spirit of Ramadan by silencing the guns, delivering more aid, and releasing the Israeli hostages held by Hamas. Israel has so far resisted American and international pressure to get more aid to Gaza's people. Some of the most vulnerable are now dying from starvation, hospitals say.
President Zelensky has hailed Ukraine's first ever Oscar, won by the documentary 20 Days in Mariupol, which details the brutal Russian siege of the port city. He said it showed the truth about what he termed Russian terrorism. The documentary's Ukrainian director, Mstislav Chernov, said he wanted to highlight the suffering of the Ukrainian people.
Right now, unfortunately, Ukraine and the topic of supporting Ukraine became a bargaining chip for a lot of politicians in the world. And I hope I remind everyone with our film that this is a humanitarian catastrophe. This is not a political question. This is a humanitarian emergency, a matter of supporting the civilians that are being attacked and being killed.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Russia has expressed concern that other prisoners there could suffer the same fate as Alexei Navalny. Mariana Katsarova said the opposition leader's death in a Russian prison was Moscow's responsibility, as he was either killed in detention or died from conditions that amounted to torture. World News from the BBC. Portugal's president, Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa, has said he'll consult parties that won seats in Sunday's inconclusive parliamentary election before appointing a prime minister. The process is scheduled to last more than a week. The centre-right Democratic Alliance has emerged as the biggest group, but it won't command a majority. The European Union has adopted a new regulation to increase transparency of political advertising. It aims to make it easier for people to recognise political advertisements, understand who's behind them, and know whether they have been specifically targeted. The EU has said the new regulation would put people in a better position to make informed choices. Passengers on a LATAM flight between Australia and New Zealand said they were told by the pilot that his instrument panel went momentarily blank when the plane suddenly lost altitude. Witnesses described people being thrown across the cabin, leaving blood on the ceiling. One of the passengers on board, Brian Jockett, was awakened from his sleep by the incident.
All of a sudden, the plane just, drops. And it wasn't a turbulence type feeling drop. It was just like, boom, down. And then it felt like it was going over the top of a roller coaster as you hit the apex and was heading downwards. And it woke me up instantly. And I looked up towards the ceiling. My head was back. And my person sitting next to me was glued to the ceiling.
A court in Germany has sentenced an American man named as Troy B. to life in prison for the rape and murder of a tourist and the attempted murder of her friend. He attacked his two victims, American women in their early 20s, at Neuschwanstein Castle, one of Germany's best-known tourist sites. And that's the latest BBC News.
WORT 89.9 FM Madison has been streaming since the turn of the century, but the best way to tune in is on the WORT app. The WORT app allows you to listen to our live stream or archived shows anywhere you can use your phone. It features sections covering the latest news, music happenings, and talk stories, as well as a listing of our podcasts and a current playlist. And you can access and track through our archives seamlessly. You can connect to our social media pages or send us a message through the app or fall asleep listening to WORT with our handy sleep clock. Download the app from Play Store for your Android or from the App Store for your Apple devices. Interact and listen to your favorite community radio station with the WORT app, all from the comforts of phone.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency.
Welcome to A Public Affair. I'm Douglas Haynes, your Monday host. The Public Affair team wants to thank you and the thousand or so other listeners who donated to our What Happened to Winter pledge drive. The on-air drive is over, but if you missed a chance to donate to the drive, you can still do it online. We'd much appreciate your support. All thank you gifts are still available, including the very popular Another Weirdo for Wart hoodie designed by P.S. Miller. You can go to wortfm.org to donate. We're very grateful and thank you for partnering with our volunteers to make possible all that we do here at Wart. It's really good to be back in the studio today after an unexpected break. I'd like to just add a little personal note here. I'd like to dedicate today's show to my father, David Haynes, and my father-in-law, Larry Solon, who both died recently and were great supporters of community radio and the arts. Today, I'm very grateful to have a renowned visual artist with me in the studio to talk about his role in the Year of Environmental Art at UW-Madison, the relationship between art and environmental justice, and his own groundbreaking work as a digital artist. Tim Portlock is a professor of environmental studies and art at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also a prolific artist who has exhibited his work around the world to much critical acclaim. A 2016 review of Portlock's Ash and Gold exhibit in the magazine Art Forum says, "With mesmeric colors and shadows, Portlock envisions bankrupt cities as beautiful." Art critic Flora Ward calls Portlock a digital poet of the post-industrial age. Uniting all of his work is a deep concern for the relationship between place, culture, and identity, especially in America's deindustrializing cities, something we talk a lot about here on A Public Affair. And I'm very excited to have this opportunity to talk with you here in the studio, Tim Portlock. Welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome to all of you listening today. If you'd like to share an observation about the relationship between art and environment, or have a question for my guest, Tim Portlock, please do give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd love to have you join the conversation today. Tim, I'd like to start real broadly just by talking about the relationship between visual art and environmental and social justice. This year, the Center for Culture, History, and Environment at UW-Madison is hosting a Year of Environmental Art events on campus. What are the roles of visual arts and environmental studies? I know that's no small question, but we'll start there and have you think out loud a little bit about how visual arts create different kinds of conversations than other kinds of conversations that arise in academic contexts about environmental issues.
So I think that there's a lot of different kinds of art. And so there's a lot of different ways that art kind of merges or overlaps with environmental studies. I'll just kind of name a couple of the bigger sort of tendencies that I see. Of course, there's always going to be lots and lots of exceptions, right? I think that like one really prominent component is art that basically articulates some of the major concerns of environmentalism. Art that makes it clear and puts concerns from environmental studies in very human terms. And then there's another component, which is, I think, kind of what I'm personally more interested in, which is thinking about what the idea of nature is. Nature has meant many different things in many different time periods. So the idea of nature is wilderness, feral, a source of abundance. Nature is pure. Nature is sublime. Like all of these are different definitions of nature that has come out of different time periods and also different cultural contexts. And I think all of them exist simultaneously today. And I think it's a lot of how some artists can plug into environmentalism and environmental studies is thinking about how these definitions merge or mesh with things that are coming out of the sort of the science end of environmental studies.
There's so much there that you just mentioned that I want to dive into. The sublime, the dialogue you have with American quote-unquote environmental art, landscape painting, way back to the 18th and 19th centuries. We'll talk about that as well, but let's start first a little bit more with ideas of nature that you just mentioned that come up in these different periods of art and representations of nature in different periods of art. One way people think about nature in art these days is sort of landscape art.
Mm-hmm.
That is landscape installations. Right? That's one thing that may come to mind for many people, in addition to kind of representational art that represents landscapes. But you're doing something a little bit different that is neither of those two things, right? Tell us a little bit more about how you would position yourself in terms of ideas of nature in the contemporary art world.
So one of the things that I'm really interested in is how nature was used in image making in an earlier period to embody ideas about national identity, specifically American national identity. When America was a new country, there were a group of people that went from being colonists to Americans. And they were participants in the conversation about how to define what is an American identity. And so their images articulate this, and these are like very idealized ideas, and you can see the beginnings of, you know, Manifest Destiny in this imagery. And what I have been historically interested in is using that visual vocabulary to talk about the differences between sort of the ideals of Americanness as embodied in their images of nature with sort of contemporary lived reality in most American major cities. You know, since I've been doing this work, what cities mean have changed. You know, like I started making this work around the time of the economic collapse of 2008. And one of the interesting things that had changed was, deindustrialization. I mean, it had been an ongoing process, but the sort of economic collapse was sort of like the apex of deindustrialization at that point. And these were the things, like industrialization was like representative of the things that had sort of reduced nature in our experience, right? And so now there was concern about nature taking over cities, you know, is a sort of emblematic of the failure of cities. And I just thought that was really ironic and tried to capture that in my work.
Yeah, so it brings to mind this series you have, Nichols from Heaven, where you have juxtaposed images of these sleek, reflective, often glass surfaces with trees on roofs, rooftop gardens, little pockets of green in abandoned spaces. Tell us more about that series and if that relates to this kind of new urban reality that you're talking about.
Right, so a few years back, I had started to reevaluate my work. It had been like the 10-year kind of anniversary of the 2008 economic collapse. And the idea of the empty and abandoned building had taken on a different meaning in the popular consciousness. You know, like now you see an empty and abandoned building, it's like an opportunity, right? Whereas before it was like a sign of things going wrong. So construction cranes were ubiquitous in most American major city skylines. And I wanted to capture the destruction and construction that was going on simultaneously. And part of the imagery from that series was thinking about how ideas about nature were embodied in some of these processes. And then also an idealized, version of nature, right? Like rooftop gardens, individual trees that are embedded in like a sea of concrete. That there is a mythology about nature that is still held onto while all this destruction of nature is still going on. Those are some of the big issues that I was thinking about as I have been making that work.
Mm-hmm. And before we get too much farther into the themes of that work, we should probably talk a little bit as well about your media and your methods. And when I talked about, landscape art and representational painting, for example, not being what you do, tell us more about how you put your pieces together.
So I started out, most of my formal training is as a painter. And even though I no longer paint, I still really like to look at painting. And at a certain point, as a painter, I was attracted to digital image making. Part of the reason is I like how digital images can circulate in a way that paintings can't, right? Like paintings are unique objects. There really can only be one object. And so if you make work that you think has an important message in it, making it a single unique object is sort of limiting how that message circulates. And so working digitally was kind of an interesting compromise for me where I could incorporate some of the visual dynamics from painting, but then also have the paintings sort of circulate in a way that the images circulate in a way that paintings couldn't. There's a lack of physicality to digital imagery, which I kind of miss which is the physical qualities of paint.
But, in the process of creating it, you
right.
mean? Yeah.
And so the tools, the specific tools that I use visual effects tools, which are the tools that Hollywood uses to make, I don't know, fantasy creatures, fantasy places. There was a period where I was using tools from 3D computer games. I've been using drones for some of the work lately. So like I'll fly a drone around a building and take a sequence of images and convert those images into a 3D model. All of the tools that I've just mentioned, I guess if you don't know visual effects software, just think about the tools that architects use, like CAD, to design buildings. Like that's essentially what I use, is like a version of that. And then I render out a 2D image from these 3D scenes and print them out as prints and hang them on a wall.
And are they essentially collages of photographs and digitally generated images?
It's more like I sculpt quote unquote digitally sculpt building. So like typically what I would do is ride my bike or drive a car around different neighborhoods and photograph buildings that I think are relevant to whatever it is I want to talk about through the work. And then once I've collected enough of these photographs, I'll use this software to make 3D digital models of any of these buildings. So all of my work has buildings or contains buildings or landscape references from actual places. But I'm actually creating those objects with software, not from photography. I use photography mainly as like reference for the 3D sculpting that I do.
So you're creating worlds and original juxtapositions of realistic images, or mostly realistic images, in other words.
So, right, like the style of imagery is realistic, but then I'm taking creative license. And this is kind of a creative process I borrowed from 19th century American landscape painters, right? Like American landscape painters. So oftentimes, American landscape painters from the 19th century would go to particular or specific locations in, you know, the United States to make paintings, right? And they would make creative choices about how to paint those places. Most people would look at those paintings who did not know and think they were realistic images. And on some level, the style of imagery was realistic. But the painter took creative license to massage the details in the image to tell a story about how the physical features of the American landscape embodied ideas of Americanism or American identity. And so when people would look at these paintings, it would sort of illustrate or impress upon them that, you know, Americanness is embodied in the geography of the country. So I myself do something similar, but I make it more obvious that I'm constructing these images to tell a story. Mm-hmm. So I might have buildings from a real city, but I will be selective as to what buildings I put next to each other. So when I was making work about Philadelphia, where I lived for 9 years, I would put, you know, the first or second Congress of the United States, which is a building in downtown Philadelphia, right across the street from a warehouse that was constructed in the middle 20th century. And I was trying to make a point by juxtaposing these two buildings next to each other. The building that is newer is in worse shape than the building that was older. And what is implied by that difference?
Yeah, I want to dive into juxtaposition some more here in a minute, and specifically your juxtapositions and dialogue with 19th century American painting. But I want to remind listeners, we're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM. And my name is Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today with Madison artist and UW-Madison professor Tim Portlock about art, urban landscapes, and teaching art and environmental studies. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. So, Tim, as you were talking about American landscape painting in the 19th century and then how you're juxtaposing images of contemporary cities, I was thinking about a famous painting by John Gast called American Progress, which has this sort of angel of mm-hmm. progress moving westward. It's sort of the embodiment of manifest destiny. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Native Americans fleeing to the west on the left-hand side of the painting, and quote-unquote settlers on the right-hand side moving in. And to me, that just jumped out at me because it is, unlike some landscape paintings that are less contrived, maybe, like I'm thinking of Albert Bierstadt or something, mm-hmm. you know, just a landscape, beautiful mountains, something sublime. It's very contrived, right? This American progress of taking all these elements, real elements of a landscape, but putting them together in this clearly meant to be pedagogical or didactic way, right? Could you dialogue just sort of on the spur of the moment with that painting for me, if there are similarities or differences between what you're trying to do and update that vision?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting that you brought up Albert Bierstadt, right? Because I would assert that his paintings were more contrived, right? I mean,
interesting.
So, okay. His paintings sort of functioned under the assumption that he actually visited the places that he painted, right? I mean, I think he was from Germany. And he came to America and he wanted to paint the American landscape. And then he wanted to take these paintings of this exotic place called America and sell them in Europe. But really what he was painting was the mountains of the Alps, mm-hmm. Between Italy or Northern Italy. And really what he was doing was sort of adapting sort of European expectations of nature to like an American context, mm-hmm. and just, you know, calling it American. But he wasn't explicit about this. Like he didn't talk about these as like made up, right? Whereas in the image that you're talking about,
American Progress,
to me, it is very obviously meant to explain something, right? Like there's an angel. The angel is holding telegraph wires and bringing technology. You know, the West is bringing mm-hmm. technology further west. So I think that the image itself. Was constructed from a perspective of manifest destiny. But I feel like it's very obviously full of like ideas, mm-hmm. right? Whereas I feel like the other kinds of paintings are trying to hide that fact. Like it's like, oh, this is a fact, right?
Right.
Yeah, I think that on some level, I like to think that my work functions like the painting where you have the angel uh-huh. carrying, you know, telegraph poles, right? Like this is explaining something, it's a process that is happening, right? Rather than like articulating what's already there.
Mm-hmm. I think that leads us nicely to talking about your presentation that you're going to be giving this Wednesday as part of this year of environmental art at UW-Madison. You're going to be presenting Cityscape Landscape on Wednesday at noon in Science Hall on UW-Madison campus. Tell us a little bit more about that and whether these ideas are present in that presentation you're going to give on Wednesday.
So I'm going to just be talking about my art and my evolution of my ideas as an artist, how I started out basically around 2007 going all the way up to like the sort of last big project that I've done. The sort of most recent sort of finished project that I did was I interviewed a couple of former residents of this housing project called Pruitt Igo in St. Louis. What I've been trying to do, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot since I've been making work for the this series of work for the last 15 years is, how I represent the different places that I visit. What is my role as an outsider and what is an ethical way as an outsider to record or convey my opinion about a place and how to incorporate the perspectives of others. So to bring it back to your question, I'm just going to talk about the different things that inform how I make my work and sort of my evolution in the last 15 years. I've been making art a lot longer, right? Like I mentioned earlier, I started out as like a more traditional painter. So I may talk about that a little bit also.
Mm-hmm. One thing I just enjoyed hearing about is the kind of oral history or interview element that you just mentioned in this St. Louis project. You've written about how the research for your digital work is very physical and tangible. Even though you were just talking about how, you know, you miss the tangibility of the mm-hmm. painting part, but it sounds like you have a lot of research for this digital work that is about walking with people through cities, talking to people about their experiences. Tell us more about that research process and how it creates art.
So different cities have different dynamics. That's like really obvious. Some cities like Las Vegas are set up to be sort of like spectacles to be looked at and experienced like that. In that instance, like, I feel that it's less ethically suspect to go in and like make observations and like report on them. But then there are other cities where I feel like you can read about them, but you actually, you're still missing important information. And that's where I feel like it's important to meet with people who live in these places and try and get a sense of like, how do people who live there experience it? And, you know, that's tricky also, right? It's like, who do you talk to and who's representative? Who's the representative perspective? And I don't think there's like, you know, a solution to that. Like, you have to just do the best job you can. But I think it's better than not talking to anyone at all and just sort of coming in with your preconceptions.
The kind of Bierstadt approach.
Right. and sometimes your preconceptions are like, right, you know? And also sometimes your perception of what's going on in a place is contrary to what the people who live there think. And I think that's sometimes okay and sometimes not okay, right? Like, if there's something wrong that people are not aware of and you as an outsider can see that, like, I think it's important to be able to talk about that. That's how things change. But anyway, I think that that dialogue is important to make the work be more authentic, or try to make it more authentic. Like, you know, it's a goal. It's not like you can say like it gets a certificate.
Mm-hmm. Certificate of authenticity.
Right, exactly.
Of the urban experience.
But also like you get insight into the place. Like, so for some of the, like, the longer I have thought about this, the more I have developed techniques for trying to incorporate the perspectives of others. So like, you know, when I was going to Las Vegas to make work about Las Vegas, I would meet with a reporter from the local public radio affiliate, right, who knew the city really well, and she was really plugged into the immigrant community. And like, you know, like at that point I wasn't really aware of that immigration was a major part of Las Vegas experience. And then I was invited to do a body of work about Camden, New Jersey, which is like the poorest major city in the United States, or at least it was at that time. And I think there was a lot of preconceptions that people had about that city. And I wanted to be very careful about sort of falling into that as a trap, right? Or being lazy. Friend of a friend of a friend found like a group of former public school, retired public school teachers, and took them out to lunch and just had conversations with them. And then I had, you know, I went into these conversations with like two questions that, you know, at some point during the conversations I would bring up. And I knew by asking these two questions, I would get a lot of extra information. So, interviewing and interacting with people is really, really important. And I think it makes the story about a place even more visceral. And you can be surprised with what you can possibly challenge your preconception.
Can you tell us a story of where those preconceptions were really challenged? You mentioned that earlier, a couple minutes ago, where you went in and then talked to people and saw the place very differently.
I think, at the time, Las Vegas was the home foreclosure capital of the United States. And that's really what I was thinking about. That's what attracted me to go there, is like the story that can be told through the abandoned buildings of a city, right? And then when I was meeting with the journalist from like the National Public Radio affiliate, she was telling me like that one of the, that immigration was like at an all-time high in Las Vegas, and you're getting a lot of immigrants from East Africa, from Latin America, et cetera, et cetera. And that this was having a major impact on like unions and labor organizing in the city. And that was sort of like one element. Second element is because things were so bad in Las Vegas, entrepreneurs were using it as sort of like a test bed for their like pet urbanist theories. So the founder of Zappos, Tony Hsieh, I think his name was at the time, had spent a ton of money on bringing people into Las Vegas and trying to develop a whole radically different culture for the city. He tried to turn it into like a desert version of Silicon Valley. And then also like he tried to import the coffee shop culture of like New York City from a certain era. But anyway, learning about all these things made me think of Las Vegas not as just a boom and bust, mm-hmm. you know, to be a little cliche, a boom and bust kind of place, but also a place where it's kind of like a laboratory for people's mm-hmm. ideas. And
I know we're dealing with the limitations of the medium here, radio, but how did that translate then visually for you into your work?
Yeah, that's the challenge, right? Is like, how do you tell that story through imagery? Part of it is, you know, finding elements of the city that are very emblematic of some of these things. But I think in reality, a lot of what happens with art that, you want to tell a story is like literally you also tell that story. Like the art is actually part of a broader conversation, right? So, you know, oftentimes when I have solo shows of my own work, I'll give a talk about the work and talk about the process and like what was the meaning and what is it that I learned by doing the research. And then the what is written about the work will also sort of fill in some of the gaps. I really strive to make the work do as much of that work as possible, but I'm realistic in that it's not going to do everything.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM. My name is Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today with Madison artist and UW-Madison professor Tim Portlock about art, urban landscapes, and teaching art and environmental studies. If you'd like to join the conversation, there's still time to give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. Tim, you mentioned a little bit ago the value of the outsider's perspective in doing this research, what essentially sounds like kind of an ethnographic or reporter's approach to producing visual art, at least the research phase mm-hmm. of it. And, you know, that value of the outsider perspective is really central to any discipline that relies on interviews or an ethnographer coming in, talking to people, spending time with people in a place. I'm going to throw a little thought experiment at you here with the outsider's perspective, because part of the occasion for bringing you in today is you're new in Madison. You started last fall as the first art professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. Tell us when you look around at Madison, your outsider's perspective on what's happening in the urban landscape here and what in particular maybe sparks some creative energy for you. We were talking a little bit before the show about your first impressions. I'd love to hear you talk more about that in context here.
So my immediate impression before I moved here, I grew up in Chicago, but weirdly had never been to Madison up until kind of like in the last few years. It's a, everyone knows this who lives here. It's a very beautiful city In comparison to Chicago, it does a really good job of integrating nature and urban space in a way that most cities don't in the Midwest. But the thing that did kind of surprise me as someone who grew up in the Midwest was how expensive Madison is. And the longer I'm here, you know, the more I begin to learn about sort of housing and the relationship between Madison and the state government and how that feeds into a shortage of housing. So I was very surprised by this, that, other parts of the Midwest are still, we hear about housing becoming more expensive and that there's a shortage, but there still is a parts of the Midwest that are recovering from post-industrialism. For example, where I just came from, St. Louis, is still emerging from that, right? And so the cost of living reflects that. I'm curious how Madison evolves to deal with that. I'm still very new to Madison. I've just been here less than a year, but I'm curious when I start to get more time, when I've sort of gotten past my like orientation phase, what kind of like housing organizations are there to sort of like address this? I was just reading that Madison, the rents increases in Madison are like the highest in the United States this last year, which kind of like blew my mind. I picked the one city to move to. So anyway.
Anything visually? I mean, you mentioned the integration of art and nature, but how about the architectural landscape that strikes you?
The thing that I see the most is that the University of Wisconsin is doing a lot of construction, and there seems to be a lot of infrastructure construction going on. And so there is a sense that from that Madison is expanding, or there's more people coming and the infrastructure has to adapt to that. Mm-hmm. Basically, that's what I see. Aside from that, just as sort of like someone who appreciates architecture, I really like the old, craftsman houses and then the like persistence of like brutalist architecture in and around University of Wisconsin campus is pretty interesting contrast, right?
Mm-hmm. So you might feel a tinge of sadness about that old humanities building coming down?
Yeah, not really. Okay. it's kind of a spectacle to look at. I mean, it's just like really huge. I was just talking to someone the other day, like it seems like a very confused aesthetic. Like it looks like they wanted to make a Babylonian temple, but then they felt obligated to put in like industrial materials. Uh-huh. So it's like got this like old rough-hewn stone block, monumental aesthetic to it. And then it's got these like really fine metal details on it. And like those two things don't really seem to go together.
Well, I thought I'd try to get your outsider's perspective. Like I said, part of what I think about us doing here on this show is the work of local culture. So it's great to have somebody with fresh eyes to see what's happening in the local landscape. Tell us about what drew you to want to teach art in the context of an environmental studies program.
So I've been teaching in art and media departments for the last 25 years. It's my first time teaching in an environmental studies program. In the years since I've started teaching, I've been working with graduate students, and more frequently, the idea about the environment has been coming up when they talk about their work. To different degrees of like stringency, right? Like, so sometimes when I've heard graduate students talk about the environment, how they rationalize that that's meaningful in the work sometimes is not convincing, and then sometimes it is more convincing. And coming here seemed like an opportunity to think more carefully for me about like what can it mean when people talk about the environment in their artwork. I think kind of like the first step is like, well, what are you trying to do with your art, right? Like, are you trying to get people to do things? Like, is the environment a concerning thing that you want people to do something about? Or like I was talking about earlier, is it a more philosophical meditation about what does the environment mean in sort of the cultural sense? So coming here seemed like an opportunity to explore those things.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk a little bit about art and activism as well, because I imagine many of the students you're working with in the Nelson Institute have an interest in engaging the public and doing public action about ecological crises. How do you talk to them about what art can and can't be in relation to activism?
So that's a tricky thing, because there, like I was saying earlier in the conversation, there's always like some exceptions. Like I think of art as an attempt to find a new novel solution to something that's people recognize as a problem, whether it's a creative problem or a social problem. So I just try to ask them questions about why it is that you're doing what you're doing. And in the process of doing that, if they haven't thought of a solution, like how do you address that thing? Are you not addressing it because it doesn't matter? It's not relevant to your work? Or is it something that you just haven't considered yet and you haven't? So some of the issues that I talk about with them, like, you know, the one I just said already, it's like, well, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to activate people with your work to do some kind of action? The other thing is, you know, a lot of art about political things or social things isn't about getting people to do things in the immediate sense, but rather the art is providing a model, an alternate model about how to do things, right? Like, what if we lived our lives this other kind of way? And that's not an immediate thing. I mean, I guess it is kind of like getting people to take an action, but it's more of like how immediately you want people to take the action. I would say in general, again, there are exceptions. I don't think art is like the most efficient medium for getting people to take immediate action on things. I think generally art is something that's probably a little more contemplative. I think we could expand our idea of what art is to incorporate mediums that we traditionally don't consider art. You know, it's like, can TikTok be an art form or an art medium, right? And I think if there's art, if there's TikTok art, and I think there could be, there might even be now that I'm not aware of, I think that that medium has a track record of getting people to act in a very immediate way, right? Like, name any kind of political thing that's been happening in the last 5 years.
So in that case, it depends to some extent, not just on the image or images themselves, but on the medium for reaching people.
Right. So, you know, like making a painting, like it's a slow process to make the painting, and then it's a slow process to disseminate the painting. And then you're also communicating to limited groups of people, right? If you work in like digital media based art, you are increasing the odds of your image circulating and people being able to contemplate what it is that you think is they should be looking at, right, or thinking about. So that's what one, you know, some of the ways I try to get people to think. The other thing is there's a sustainability aspect to art in the environment that I think it's important for people to think about. Some artists are very concerned getting back to like art as a model for how we should live or how like the kinds of things we should be doing. It's like sustainability in art is like a very prominent thing. But I think if people are making art about the environment and it's not sustainable, like what are the trade-offs that you've thought about as the artist, right? Like, I know several artists who use data to talk about the environment, right? So there's a computer that's processing information, and that process creates pollution, a small amount of pollution, but it's creating pollution. Like, is the trade-off to communicate broader things about the environment worth that small amount of pollution?
Mm-hmm. So it's a whole kind of different conversation about materials, it sounds right. like. Yeah. And what the contribution of the materials to produce art is to environmental problems. Do students express an impatience with that idea that art works on us in sort of unseen ways sometimes, or works on our hearts rather than, or reframing our perspectives rather than, you know, getting something done, quote unquote?
So I've been working with, up until this year, I've been working with students who are getting a degree in art. And this is my very first semester, like the spring semester, working with students who are not getting a degree in art. They're like getting environmental. So I'm still sort of like learning what their expectations are about art. I think what they think about how their discipline interfaces with art is something that I'm in the process of learning mm-hmm. also. I think part of what I'm doing is sort of expanding what art could be, you know, like I think some people, you know, come into art making with an idea that it's like painting, drawing, sculpture, et cetera, et cetera. And then part of what my job is to say, well, it's also these other things. It could be like TikTok videos, right? Or it can be 3D computer game animation, et cetera, et cetera. So I think once there's awareness of that, that sort of unlocks more things that can be said or articulated, and more ways that the materials can embody some of the ideas that are relevant to what they're interested in.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to A Public Affair. I'm your Monday host, Douglas Haynes. I'm talking today with Madison artist and UW-Madison professor Tim Portlock. There's still time to join our conversation. Give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. I just got a note. We had a caller who just wanted to reach out to you, Tim, and say, hey, you might be interested in joining the Madison Trust for Historic Preservation as a way to explore some of those interests you were talking about in Madison earlier.
Okay. I'll Google that.
All right. So that's from Colleen. Thanks, Colleen, for checking in. So in the time we have left here, Madison or Tim, I want to continue the conversation a little bit about kind of the public role of art. And maybe we can expand that beyond the classroom too. But we'll start with teaching. What gives you hope in teaching art? We'll talk about the teaching, and then maybe we'll talk about the practicing art as well. But let's talk about that notion of hope a little bit.
I like that people are always responding to the culture that they live in. And I don't know if like I would call that hope, but I get a lot of fulfillment from seeing how young people are taking sort of this lineage of vocabulary and applying it to new situations, or thinking about how this pre-existing vocabulary might be adapted to new things, and being surprised by things that they come up with. Also, new solutions to old issues is another thing that I really enjoy observing. You know, and the idea of the environment has been around in art for a while. And I think that things have come a long way since like land art, right? And it's just been really interesting, you know, to witness the evolution of that discussion. Another discussion that's been interesting, it's like, you know, apart from, you know, the environment, is just the idea of like identity in art has evolved dramatically since, you know, I was an art student. So it's always exciting to see those changes.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like those changes overlap with some of your own concerns about urban spaces, inequalities in urban spaces, how we inhabit urban spaces?
I think so. I've been I've been impressed by how a lot of the energy that I felt was kind of like low key interest in like the city as a subject matter has grown over the last few decades since I've like been making this kind of work. And I think there's just more enthusiasm about that kind of work.
I want to steer us, we just have a couple minutes left, to one other direction, one thing we haven't gotten to talk about a little bit, which is this notion of the sublime.
Okay.
Or beauty. Because of course that is one thing that draws people to art. And for many people, maybe the first thing they think of, beauty. I know the sublime and beauty are not exactly equal, but
right.
For our purposes now, we'll just kind of think about that as something that draws people to art. You have a collection called Sublime Light of Fortune. I know reviewers have kind of talked about you being involved in inventing a new notion of American sublime, centered on decaying post-industrial urban landscapes. What does beauty mean to you? And maybe we'll go after there. What relevance is beauty today for helping us think about art and the landscape?
Right. I mean, I think of beauty as kind of like a quality to an image. Like I think it's a way of attracting people ultimately to your ideas, and kind of holding them there long enough to contemplate your ideas. I don't think beauty in of itself is like that important to art anymore. I understand historically why that was viewed as like a signifier of something else, that it was communing with God or communing with the timeless something or other. But I don't think there is something like noble or moral about something that is beautiful. I think it might be different if we're talking about nature. Like, I think that's a more arguable thing that is as something that's important. I think appreciation of nature is something that's, there is a value to that. Like, that you look at nature and you're impressed by it, that it's a spectacle. I think that's, you know, helps to connect you to why stewardship of nature is important.
Like a sense of wonder, kind of,
right,
what you're describing.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think the idea of the sublime, like embodied through art, is kind of a, you know, so, I mean, it depends on like whose definition of the sublime we're talking about, but I would say, you know, generally, you know, the idea is that it's like your capacity to comprehend something that's like so impressive, like that you're struggling, and that there's this, that through this struggling, it's like you're communing with something that's bigger than who you are. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know if I believe that, but so get back to your question.
Yep.
Yeah, I think beauty is important for art in so much as it draws people into thinking about the work.
And for nature as well, it sounds like, or yeah, the human connection,
yeah,
to nature. Well, Tim Portlock, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. I appreciate you coming to the studio and having a one-on-one intimate conversation. This is the kind of conversation we get to have here on A Public Affair. I feel very lucky to be a part of. Want to thank you all again for your gifts, those of you who pledged for this last pledge drive, and there's still a chance to contribute if you value what you hear here, and also you can share what you hear here on our archive, on our podcast, with folks that you think would be interested. So Tim Portlock, UW-Madison professor, world-renowned artist, thank you for coming into the studio today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And I'd also like to thank today's engineer, Andrew Thomas, producer Jade Iseri Ramos, news director Shali Pittman, receptionist Amy Letsky, And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WORT 89.9 FM Madison. My name is Douglas Haynes. Stay tuned today for Madison Book Beat. Up next is David Ahrens talking with Cynthia Simmons, media professor and former WORT news director, about her book Wrong Kind of Paper.
Pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted.
And you are listening to listener sponsored community radio 89.9 FM Madison. Call letters, of course, are WORT. Stay tuned for BBC headlines, and then after that, Madison Book Beat. Pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has joined leaders of Caribbean nations in Jamaica for emergency talks on the crisis in Haiti, where gang leaders are demanding the resignation of the Prime Minister. The State Department said they discuss a proposal developed by the regional bloc, CARICOM, and Haitian stakeholders to speed up a political transition. Will Grant has the latest.
It is expected that the nations of the Caribbean community will call for Prime Minister Henri to resign and set out steps towards a transitional administration. The Biden administration, which initially backed Mr. Henri, is likely to agree with such a plan given the severity of the crisis. However, even if the Prime Minister does step down, Haiti faces huge challenges. The UN Security Council is hoping a Kenyan-led international security force can help to rein in the heavily armed gangs.
The UN Secretary General has called for a ceasefire in Gaza to mark Ramadan, the Muslim month of fasting. Antonio Guterres also called for the release of hostages held by Hamas and the speedy delivery of aid to the Palestinian territory. President Zelensky has hailed Ukraine's first ever Oscar, won by the documentary 20 Days in Mariupol.